So you've got these images of the path and of the mandala. But the stupa brings something extra to it. It's a three-dimensional image. It's a little bit like a sort of a Legoland version of the Buddhist path, it seems to me, because you're constructing yourself, you're constructing your life in these very, very interesting shapes, and the shapes also have colours and all sorts of associations with them. And I wanted to start by my first experience of a stupa. And this involved a procession. There was this amazing procession. And in the procession, there were Thai monks and Japanese monks and some Sri Lankan monks all in their robes. The Japanese ones had these headdresses on and little fans and drums that they were holding. You may have seen that kind of Japanese monk, monks and nuns, actually. And there were many lay people. There were people holding banners. And I sort of found myself caught up in this procession. I was given this banner to hold. You know, it's a bit like going on a trade union march or something, holding one of these things. And we were sort of all trudging down, you know, along this track. And eventually we came to the stupa, this amazing stupa, just freshly painted, completely new stupa. And at the head of the procession was an elephant as well. So we had an elephant bringing us all along. And there it was, and they inaugurated the stupa. And I'll show you some photographs of that later on. Can anybody who doesn't know already guess where this was? What exotic place the procession? It was in Milton Keynes. It was in Milton Keynes, yes. I don't know where they got the elephant from.
They hired it from the
gang. Yes, probably they... Yes, where... Where do you hire elephants from? Yes. Yes. So in Milton Keynes, the stupa there is called the Peace Pagoda. Here it is. It's a very beautiful stupa, yes. In fact, one of the mitras here, Bob, was there day before yesterday with his little granddaughter, just sitting there. He's had a lovely afternoon there, he was saying. Anyway, so... that was my first experience. And when the procession arrived at the stupa, one of the monks, there was a ladder, huge ladder, going right up, well, I should have a long thing, but right up to the top of the roof there. I can't quite reach it with my little thing. And so the ladder went up, so just above the roof, that sort of domey black area above the roof. And this monk shinned up the ladder with a little rucksack on, took something out of the rucksack, put it inside that thing at the top, and then he released millions of flowers, all flew out and settled on the... And there were hundreds and hundreds of people there. They settled on the whole audience. It was really lovely. And now the interesting thing is, what was he putting in the stupa? Again, can anyone guess what it was? It's very, very traditional. It was a relic. It was actually some ashes of the Buddha himself. Because apparently they're still, in Sri Lanka, there are enough of them for them to be able to divide them up and send them around to all these different stupas. So this was donated by the Sri Lankan Sangha. And some. So there, if anyone asks you, well, where is the Buddha buried then? You can say, oh, Milton Keynes. And so this was the issue. This is how stupas began, in a way, at least how Buddhist stupas began, with the whole problem of what to do with the Buddha after he died. What do you do with the body of a Buddha after he's died? And of course, people asked the Buddha about this before he died. So what do we do about it? And he gave a number of different answers to this question. The first answer was basically, well, just leave it to people who are interested in such things, which I think is quite a good answer, really. But when he was pressed, he also said, well, in general, an awakened one or a great hearer, a great enlightened disciple, should be commemorated by a stupa. And they said, what is a stupa? And so what he did was, he took off his outer robe, because as you probably know, Buddhist monks wear three robes, or three cloaks, you could say, the outer one. He folded it up, and he put it on the ground like that, and then he took his begging bowl and he put that on the top, and he said, that is a stupa. And they said, oh, right, that's a stupa, yes. There is a bit more to the story than that, because in fact, these kind of monuments were already in use in ancient India and, in a way, all over the world. And they were originally used to commemorate great chieftains, leaders, kings, and so on. And so after the Buddha died, there was, in fact, not one stupa built, but, well, there are very different versions of the story, but probably 10 stupas were built. And so his ashes were apportioned between these 10 stupas in different centres of Buddhism, because Buddhism was already spread quite extensively in Buddhism by that in India by that time. So how does it originate? What's the original the Indian or worldwide origin of this? Basically, you got your dead leader, your dead prominent person, and you stick them in the ground. You make a big mound of earth over them, and then you encase that mound in sun-baked bricks. And this is the way that the leaders were commemorated. And they were particularly commemorated in this way if the local religion was an earth goddess religion. And in India, this was actually called a womb mound, or sometimes an egg mound. Garbha is the word for womb, and anda is the word for egg. And this was what these mounds were called. And I want to give you an example, if this works, of one from elsewhere. Actually, so someone might have seen this.
That looks like an Iron Age.
It is. It's actually pre-Iron Age. Pre-Iron Age. What country?
Ireland.
That is right. So this is one of these great Neolithic mounds in Nowth, a place called Nowth in Ireland. And this one is at Newgrange. And this is the largest in Europe, and it is absolutely tremendous. I've been to visit it. You can be taken inside the inner chamber where the bones were placed. That's also in Ireland, Newgrange, not far from Dublin, well worth a visit. And this white wall is a wall made of quartz, which catches the sun as it rises, so that the whole mound can be seen for many miles around. And you can see there are standing stones around it and all sorts of things. So you get this sense, all over the world these mounds were being made, these sort of egg mounds. But at the same time as people were being buried in mounds, there was another form of religion around. So as well as the earth mother religion, or the earth goddess religion, there was the sky god religion. And, I mean, this may be very oversimplified, but at least some say there was a sort of a great rivalry between the two religions and the cultures they represented and the different values they upheld. So this other kind of religion was based on fire and gods who lived in the sky. And in that case, the ceremonies were sacrifices held on an altar. And the altar would normally be under the village tree. Certainly in India, it would be under the village tree. And this kind of religion still exists in India. So this is a Hindu priest conducting a fire ceremony in front of an image of a Hindu god. And the fire ceremony is originally in Hinduism. This would be animal or even human sacrifice, where it's said that the spirit of the creature or the person would be sent up in smoke up to join the sky gods. And this shows the ceremony being conducted in a way that's happened for thousands of years in India, under the village, sacred village tree. You see, the village tree is decorated, and the priest is conducting the ceremony around a fire, and the smoke is going up through the leaves of the tree.
Were the dead cremated, or were they just buried whole?
In the earth, in the earth mother religion, they were buried whole. And in the sky god religion, they were cremated. I mean, this is probably very, very oversimplified, but roughly speaking, that's what went on. And I've got another one, I think. Here we are, another sacred village tree. And this is actually a Bodhi tree, in fact. But the Bodhi tree is not just sacred to Buddhism, because I'm pretty certain that this is a Hindu shrine. and not a Buddhist shrine. There's no evidence of any Buddhism there. But you see all the flowers that are heaped up there, the local villagers who are still regard this as their sacred tree. I was reading a bit about this actually this morning, but you can ask me later if you like. But why is it that it's the Bodhi tree in particular that is often the one that appears in these shrines? And there's some scientific research about that. So these two religions were in opposition to each other. But Buddhism, as it often did, rather than demonizing its previous religions, it would actually sacralize them. And it would say they are both valid and both useful, and it brought them together. And I hope this is where we come to the point of the stupa, because the stupa brings both of them together. It unites them. And so the early form of the stupa, we have a platform made. On the platform is the mound, the under, the garbha. At the top of the mound is the fire altar. So they make the fire altar on the top. And so when the if a body is cremated there, the ashes will fall through, and there's a shaft that runs right down into the centre of the mound, which will receive the ashes. So this is the primitive basis of the Buddhist stupa, combining the earth mother mound with the sky god altar, fire altar on the top, and then above that is the tree. And in fact, this would be, of course, not literally a tree, because the tree wouldn't survive the fire. So instead of that, they put up a royal parasol. So you'll see a royal parasol surmounting the fire altar. And the royal parasol, this is the symbol of kingship. In the same way as in this country, the crown is the symbol of kingship or queenship. In India, it was the royal parasol that was a symbol. So you'll see that on the top, symbol of sovereignty. So let's see if I've got a picture of this. So here you can see the great stupa at Sanchi. So can you see these elements? You'll see there's a platform at the bottom, and then there's a great mound, in this case encased in stone rather than in brick. Then you have what's called a harmika, which is a survival of the old fire altar, and then surmounting that is the royal parasol, a three-tiered parasol here. And here's a diagram of that. Does that make sense? So I think of this as being, rather fancifully, we've got the egg cracks open, and out of the egg, a tree bursts out, flaming at its base. So that's the image I have in my mind for this, in a way, unifying of the earth and sky religions in this Buddhist symbol. So this unification indicates what the stupa is about. The stupa represents integration, not just integration in a cultural sense of two different religions, but a progressive integration of the earthy parts of us with the fire or sky parts of us. And this integration process goes on until complete integration, complete enlightenment. So every Buddhist country has its own special architectural style of stupa, trying to illustrate this process. And in ancient India and in Sri Lanka, this is a image of the ancient Indian stupa. If you look carefully, you should be able to see the dome. You should be able to see the harmika, the fire altar. And you should be able to see the parasol at the very top. And then the stupa was worshipped. I think I may have missed a few slides here. Yeah, let's have a look at this one. Yes, this one, instead of the... this is in Sri Lanka. And instead of the parasol, there was a spire originally, although the top part of the spire has gone. These are very ancient, some of these stupas. And this one shows stupa worship going on. So you can see the stupa on the left, and you see men and women paying homage to the stupa. Again, you can make out the dome, the square structure, and then the parasol above it. And I'll just go back again to the one with the lights on. because this is again what traditionally would be done with a stupa. This one's also in Sri Lanka. And the whole stupa was covered in niches. Every niche would have a little lamp lit. So on the special festival days, everybody would gather around the stupa and they would gaze at this beautiful monument covered in light. There would be flowers being offered, there would be incense burning, lectures on Buddhism would be given, people would be meditating, they'd spend the whole night there around the stupa. It'd be a big party as well, a big sort of religious party in a way. And this stupa is being venerated by elephants. A very old carving, more than 2,000 years old, of a stupa. And this is a stupa in Nepal, the Bodhnath stupa, showing the way they're lit up. I'll say a little bit more about the Nepalese style of stupa later. And this is a stupa, again, someone might recognise this one.
Norfolk.
This is a stupa in Norfolk, yes. So this is at Padmaloka, the retreat centre in Norfolk. And again, being venerated with lights and circumambulation, everyone walking around the stupa clockwise, doing walking meditation. This is the traditional thing to do. And this is the one in Milton Keynes. This is not actually the opening ceremony, it's another ceremony, but basically this is what the opening ceremony was like, with the Japanese monks, the altar, with Fuji Guruji, who's the founder of the Japan Buddha Sangha there. And an image here, an image of the Buddha as a child, which maybe you're not so familiar with, the golden image. And around the stupa, there are Indian-made stone friezes showing different episodes from the life of the Buddha. And you can see this long, this flat platform along here, which allows you to circumambulate the stupa, or you can go up the steps and circumambulate it at the next level. Or you can go up and circumambulate it. Actually, you can't on this one, I think. But sometimes you can keep going up level upon level and circumambulate the stupa at different places. And here's another stupa of lights. This is from the Women's Retreat Centre in Shropshire. This was a stupa made of paper illuminated from within. So I hope you get a sense of how ubiquitous the stupa is in Buddhist traditions in all Buddhist countries. So I want to show you some stupas from different parts of the Buddhist world. This one, which is covered in real gold leaf, which people keep adding to, is in Thailand. So the Thai stupas get very, very... they're very spirit-based stupas, aren't they? Because they sort of zoom into the sky, rather like spaceships. This one is Burmese. This one is Chinese. Now, interestingly, the Chinese stupas lose a lot of, some of them at least, lose a lot of the basic elements, as if they only retain the umbrella or the spire at the top. And the argument for this is, well, you regard the whole planet as being the garbha, the under, the womb underneath it. This is a Japanese stupa, pagoda. So you can see some similarity between this and the Milton Keynes one. The Milton Keynes one is Japanese, but it returns to some earlier stupa forms.
Is that what a pagoda is? It's a stupa.
A pagoda is a stupa, yes. The word pagoda is actually a Portuguese word. Although, funnily enough, the Sri Lankan word for the stupa is dagaba, which is a very similar word, isn't it? And for that, the gaba means the garba, the womb. This one is from Vietnam. This is a Vietnamese stupa. See the Buddhist flags around? And one Communist Party flag. And this is another Chinese-style stupa. Anybody recognise this one? That is in Kew Gardens, yes. So about 200 years ago, this stupa was imported from China and re-erected in Kew Gardens. And the Chinese ones are often, unusually, they often have temples inside them. The traditional idea of a stupa is that it's completely solid, and all the worship takes place outside, which is all very good, well, if you live in India or Thailand or something. But if you're living in Japan, you know, you want to be able to get inside, out of the cold sometimes, don't you? So they made their stupas into temples as well. And this one, anyone recognise this one? That's the Battersea Park one, yes. So this was the Battersea Park one was built by the same Japanese Buddhist sect has built the one in Milton Keynes, the Japan Buddha Sangha, whose main mission in life is to build stupas in places of conflict, and they call them peace pagodas. So, but you can see the basic elements here. You see the royal umbrella has become this multi-ringed spire at the top, and I'll say something a bit more about the elaborations of the symbolism of the stupa in a minute. And we're back here in the Milton Keynes one, and you can see how it has returned to some extent to earlier forms with the dome, but it's retained the Japanese form with the roof and the notched spire above it. So you can walk up the steps, walk around it here, or you can walk right around the base, lions guarding the main steps and so on. Well worth a visit if you've not been there. And if you can't get to Milton Keynes, then try Battersea Park or Kew Gardens. And here's the statue I mentioned of the Buddha as a child. And here are some of the friezes around the base of the stupa. So this one shows the Buddha teaching his first five disciples in the deer park, the middle one here. And here is perhaps the greatest stupa of all in the whole world, which is in Java, Borobudur. And this is a stupa which is... can you see the human beings down here? Get an idea of the scale.
Better than
pyramids. I have visited this stupa in Java, and it really is a wonder of the world. It is just a really stupendous... I mean, I'd quite like to give a lecture just about this, because you could say so much about it. It's so rich in art and symbolism. But with this one, you can circumambulate the whole thing, then you can climb to the platform at the base, circumambulate, but then you can climb to 1, 2, 3, 4 corridors, which are surrounded by friezes of Buddhist sutras. So you can actually, as it were, read the sutras in purely visual form. And then finally you break out of these corridors where you can't see. They're higher than you are, so you're just walking down a narrow passage with these beautiful images on either side, and every so often there's another image of the Buddha. On the western side, Amitabha, the Buddha of the West. On the eastern side, Akshobhya, Buddha of the East, and so on, all the Buddhas of the different directions. And then you break out on the top, this area at the top, surrounded by many miniature stupas, and you find you're on a mountaintop, it feels like, and you look all around you and you can see the volcanoes on the horizon, the paddy fields and the jungles all around. You sort of break out into the sky. It's a fantastic feeling. And to do the whole thing as a practice, it would take you at least half a day, really, to enter the stupa and to walk around one level, then the next level, then the next level, and so on. And the whole thing is a practice, a very beautiful practice. There's another aerial shot of it. And here's a close-up of one of the Buddhas inside the stupas at the top. So every stupa at the top has a Buddha, an image of the Buddha, Virochana Buddha, usually, hidden inside. Virochana Buddha being the Buddha of the centre.
It's kind of like a mandala as well.
It's a mandala as well as a stupa, that's right. It is a mandala, it's a three-dimensional mandala. And this is seeing it in the distance through the jungle. Imagine that, you know, seeing this fantastic monument. And now we move to Tibet, where the stupa is seen everywhere, where it's known as a Chorten, way up in the high mountains with the flags draped from the spire. And in this case, they often have an image of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva on the dome of the stupa. So this is the discovery by intrepid Western explorers of a Chorten in Tibet. uh, and a small accident involving Captain Haddock. Yes, well, that's all the only one I could find of this online. Yes, it's the German version. Yes, I think, is it German? Actually, it might even be Polish or Dutch. I don't know.
Very similar to Dutch.
Yeah, perhaps. Yes, I don't know. So this is the structure. I'm sorry about the lampshade being in the way at the very top of that. But this is the structure of the Tibetan stupa, or one of the structures of the Tibetan stupas. And the thing about the stupa is that it represents the structure of human potential. I talked about the process of integration, and it's immensely rich in symbolism. It represents the Buddha. It represents enlightenment, but it also shows everything that you need to build up towards enlightenment. So it's the Legoland version of the Buddhist path. It's the construction of a basis for enlightenment. That's what the thing represents. So if you contemplate it, there are meditations on the stupa. The meditations will recapitulate that process in your mind's eye. So here's another Tibetan one. So I hope we'll find one eventually where you can actually see the top. Sorry about this.
Do you know anything about the reason for the shape of the bowl, as it were, being...
Yes, I do, yes. So we get to... And there are actually, in Tibet, there are eight traditional versions of the stupa, representing different parts of the Buddha's life. Most of them very similar to each other, with just minor variations, but variations in the number of the cones and the rings and so on. But then the Parinirvana stupa is a little bit different. So you see, this Parinirvana stupa has a bell-shaped dome, but the others all have a vase-shaped dome that actually gets wider, and that does have its significance, which I may say something about. But what's going on here is that you're trying to find out about yourself. You're bringing all the unconscious parts of yourself into awareness. And you do that by building in your imagination the lower levels of the stupa. And then the higher levels represent the development of higher states of consciousness in meditation. And then at the very top, everything comes together in wisdom and compassion and finally enlightenment. See if we've got a... Here we have a diagram. So, quite fairly complicated, as you can see, the symbolism. But this summarizes some of the symbolism. And I'm not going to go through everything here, but you can see, in a way, all the teachings of Buddhism are there in the stupa. And it can be used as a sort of a mnemonic. And even the number of steps at each level reminds you of a particular... I mean, you may find this totally appalling, you know, this idea. But for some people, it can be quite useful as a memory device, you know, as a way of doing it. So we've got the square base. Sometimes it's a round base, and it's usually terraced. And this is the firm, earthy foundation that you need in the natural world, in your body. Acceptance of your ordinary nature, your emotions, your desires, the body and its needs. And then as you become integrated, the mass of this reduces step by step. So that's why you normally have a stepping in. At this lower level and stepping in up here as well. So then above that we have a vase or a pot shape. And this is the natural world and one's natural self in a new form. The form which is, you know, what is a vase or a pot or a cup like? It's receptive to what's above it, the higher potentials of the mind, like a vessel. It's a containing vessel. So that's why it becomes, in these very symbolic stupas, it normally becomes pot-shaped rather than mound-shaped. There's definitely a sense of it being a ceramic vessel that contains things. And this is a lunar stage. In fact, both the bottom are, in a way, lunar. Or you've got earth and moon, I suppose you could say. So there's a sense of the moon at this stage. It also represents the ethical phase of life. Now, actually, this one says that the ethics is in the base, but it's more commonly said that the ethical phase is in the vase. So it culminates in the gathering of all your conscious energies in meditation. So it gathers together to quite a narrow bit at the top. And then above that, you've got this notched cone, a cone with a different, various numbers, numbers of notches representing the path of meditation, successively higher states of consciousness, but all firmly based in your real experience. You've got to build this up gradually. You don't sort of build it in the sky. You build it from a very solid foundation. And this is an active or a solar phase, this or a fire phase, if you like, the notched cone above it. Then above that you have the parasol. And the parasol is interesting. This is the way I see it, at least. Okay, you're sort of clambering up, and then you've got this thing above you, and you can't get above it. You can't. You can't get through it. It's a little bit like if you're a squirrel, and somebody's put these seeds, you know, these bird feeders out. And I don't know if you've ever had this problem, but if you put out bird feeders, and there are a lot of squirrels around, the squirrels will find a way. But if you go to a good garden centre, you can get a squirrel barrier. And the squirrel barrier is a perspex dome that is shaped down like this. And the squirrel shins up the pole and bangs his head against the dome. And he tries to jump sideways and he falls off. He cannot get past that parasol shape. So it's the same. It's the same for us. We are the squirrel. And we climb up in meditation, but just climbing up doesn't take you to enlightenment. This is the point. You actually need to get off into another dimension altogether, and then you'll find yourself above the parasol. It's a change of dimension to the transcendental dimension. And then above that, you'll find a moon crescent. I'm glad we can just about see it in this example. So there's a moon crescent, so we're back from the solar to the lunar again. But this is now the lunar symbolism on a different level. It's the soft and gentle compassion of the Bodhisattva. And then there's a sun disk above that, and this is again the solar symbolism on another level. It's the enlightenment or Buddhahood as a principle outside time. It's wisdom in its fullness. So we get coming together at the very top of the stupa, compassion, the moon crescent, which is in Buddhism a traditional symbol of compassion, which I can try and explain if you want to ask about that later, and and together with the sun disk, the moon crescent for compassion, the sun disk for wisdom. But then that's not the very top. On the top of that is this very mysterious thing, which is known as the accumulated drop, or the flaming drop, or the flaming crystal. And this flaming drop or crystal or jewel at the very top is a sort of a scintillating combination of all the colours of the rainbow, never still, impossible to look at. And this represents everything brought together, the complete transcendence of all opposites, even of wisdom and compassion. So that's enlightenment as something perfect. So do you see the representation of the whole path here? There's the natural ground out of which emerges the ethical life, out of that emerges meditation, out of that emerges wisdom and compassion, and finally out of that emerges enlightenment. The soil bears an egg. The egg cracks open and a fir tree bursts out of the egg, flaming at its base and bearing a star at its summit. So the tree, the fir tree with the star at its summit, is an aspect of the same symbolism, if anyone's ever come across that before. So you need the pot at the bottom, surrounded by gifts, and out of that emerges the fir tree with the star at the summit.
Or is it sometimes a little fairy?
It may be a little fairy at the top, yes. But even she'll have a star on the end of her wand. So if the stupa is the structure of human potential, this implies that the stupa can be seen as a human being. So this shows you the way that the human body is, or the Buddha's body at least, is said to combine with the stupa. You imagine a human being, usually a Buddha, meditating within the stupa. His folded legs are the base, or on the base. His torso is the dome, or the pot shape, and his head is above that in the harmika. And above the head is the spire of meditation, above the head, and then enlightenment at the very top. And this means each of the elements of the stupa correspond to one of the chakras of the human body. And that is why you see eyes painted on Nepalese stupas. And there's another tantric image of the connection between this. I'm going to say a little bit more about this geometrical form of the stupa later on, but you see how it goes. The base of the earth element, in the belly is the water element, in the heart is the fire element of the cone, in the throat is the wind element of the parasol, and then above are the solar and lunar symbolisms and the accumulating drop. So just to give you a little bit of a summary here, here's something showing you the evolution of the stupa from the early basic form, domed form, to the later form with the elongated cone above it, to the pagoda in China, and then to the five-element stupa. So can you cope with more yet? Is this enough? Or do you want to hear about the elements as well? Does anyone want to ask anything before? Because it's 9:10 now. So anyone want to chip in with any comments before you forget? And then I can talk a little bit about this right-hand one, the stupa of the elements. Yeah, is that right?
Okay.
Sure. Okay. So we've got we've seen the psychic symbolism of the stupa, the way it represents this unfolding or this construction of a spiritual life. And we've also seen the Buddha, the human being or a Buddha in the stupa. But how do you use it? How do you use the symbolism of the stupa? And it may be it's enough just to look at stupas, circumambulate them, have a sense of them in your mind. That may be sufficient. But if you want more, then you can look at the symbolism of the five elements in the stupa. Another way of looking at the structure of human potential. And these five elements are earth, water, fire, air, and space. Or sometimes space and or consciousness. So I just want to suggest a little way of looking at these, because each of the elements, it seems to me, represents a way that you can be lost. In isolation, they need to be brought together. So each of them represents a way in which you can be stuck. Do you see what I mean? You can be stuck in the earth element, in the water element, and in the fire element, and so on. And I'll try and explain that. You're stuck in a phase of human development, unable to move on, because you've lost contact with the other elements. These are Japanese grave stupas, which show the elements. So we've got the square of the earth element at the base. Actually, that's not a use, is it? But anyway, and then you've got the round water element. You've got the sort of the hat shape in this case, or sometimes it's an inverted crescent shape of the fire element. The fire element is more like a cone. That's right, isn't it? And then you've got the inverted hemisphere of the air element, and then finally at the top you've got the space element represented by sort of a drop. And there's some more of those. So Japanese graveyards are full of these five-element stupas. And here's a Japanese explanation of the process. Earth, water, fire, wind, and space. The jewel shape at the top. Let's leave that one. Stay on this one. Okay, so the earth. So the thing about the earth element, if you're stuck in earth is a fantastic foundation, but if you're stuck in earth, it means you're literally stuck. You can't move in any direction. So you're like a bound prisoner. This is the image that Sangharakshita gives. You're like a bound prisoner, tied hand and foot, that can't move either way because you're stuck in the earth element. You're immobile. And so you need to be able to open into the water element to be able to free yourself from that. Now, the water element, water is mobile, but it's like if you pick up a washing up bowl, you can slosh the water back and forth, but it doesn't do any more than that. So it tends to move. Water can move, but it moves within that dimension. And so it's a little bit like the tendency to move between opposites, which we'll be looking at, actually. Yashobodhi will be talking about that possibly next week when we talk about the worldly winds. So pain and pleasure, obscurity, popularity, success and failure, loneliness and gregariousness, manic energy and depressed lethargy, all these different things, they're swaying between the polarized opposites. So if you're stuck in the water element, then you're somebody who is stuck. That's moving between those opposites. And in that case, you need to open up into the fire element. Now, the fire element has a vertical sense to it. It's like a Roman candle or a rocket. It goes whoosh, upwards. And so, in a way, it's a very positive thing. But if you're stuck in the fire element, if that's the right word for it, if you're lost in it, you get very excited, you get very idealistic, but you lose touch with the earth. And you end up in a shower of sparks.
Burning your candle at both ends.
Burning the candle at both ends, yes. Burning your rocket at both ends. Now, the air element is what you need to release into. And the air element represents expansion in all directions. It's totally free to move in any direction. Not just sloshing about on a level, not just rising up, but moving outwards in all directions. And maybe the way you can get stuck in this or lost in this is when you lose your identity because you're spread out over so many things. It seems at first very positive, but in a way you've lost touch with what's really important to you. You're so universal, you're at one with everything, and as a result you're completely undifferentiated. And that may mean you just don't even care what happens in a way. You just say, oh, it doesn't make any difference. You know, it's all the same. You know, everything is one, all is one. It doesn't matter what happens, you know. And it does sound very good, you know, because you feel, well, everything's fine. You know, and it's really nice to be able to feel that everything is fine, but it is not the whole story because it's a dangerous state to be in. And I think part of the danger is because you're vulnerable. You're vulnerable if you're an airhead. Yeah, but the other thing is you can be unskillful because you actually, you feel it doesn't make any, whatever happens doesn't make any difference and you lose your ethical sense. So I think that there is danger in the fire element. Now the fifth element is called akasha. Space is the usual translation into English. It's not a very satisfactory translation because akasha means the space of your mind in which all experience takes place, symbolized by the blue sky. Does that make sense? It's as if we are moving through the world, and it's particularly obvious in our visual sense, but it's true in all senses. It's as if there is a space in which it's all happening to us. And that space, the space of awareness, is what is meant by akasha. So it's not space in the sense of the bit that's between Saturn and Jupiter. It means space in the sense of all this in which our lives happen, in which our experience happens. And it's very, very positive indeed to be in touch with that space. And it's represented by the flaming drop at the top of the stupa. And this is the point of integration. So you could argue this can't really be a stuck or a lost state because everything has now been resolved. But if you wanted to, you might be able to see, you could imagine being lost in a sort of a mental world of imagination, completely out of touch with your body, if you were stuck there up in the flaming drop and had forgotten about the rest of the elements. So what the stupa is trying to do is to build up a structure of human integration. So we don't stay isolated in any one of the elements. And we do that by building them progressively. So when Paramananda teaches meditation, he's very, very keen on grounding. And the grounding is making sure you've got the earth element present there. You've got the water element present there as well. You're building up from the base. You must start with the firm and solid earth, bring in the receptive container of the water element. If you're firm enough, then you can open, you can be receptive, and you can receive the liquid of inspiration, if you like. And that water element takes the shape of whatever it occupies. And you also need to learn to rise up as well, experiencing the heights and the depths, sort of connecting the heights with the depths, finding inspiration perhaps in art and poetry, maybe finding bliss in deep spiritual experiences. But then you need the expansiveness of air, moving outwards, encountering the new, filling the space around you. So that expansiveness is important. You don't want to be rising up the whole time. You want to be opening outwards. And then you need the akasha, the single jewel drop of being completely awake in every situation. So I hope that gives you a sense of the stupa. And this is the one at Bodhnath in Nepal. And the reason the eyes are there, if you remember, is because that is where the head is if the human body and its chakras are contained inside the stupa. Oh, and that's Henry James, who has nothing to do with stupas. So I've got one thing to finish with, and this is a quote from Lama Anagarika Govinda. And Lama Govinda was a very great 20th century Buddhist of German origin, who particularly practiced in the Tibetan tradition. And this is what he says in his book on stupas, which I'd recommend. It's through the language of archetypal symbols that we reconnect ourselves with the primordial ground from which all human culture has sprung. Among the oldest of architectural forms, the stupa is a universal symbol of enlightened mind, a familiar sight in all countries where Buddhism has flourished. In the stupa we find the ancient reliquary monuments, once built for kings and heroes, transformed into profound expressions of knowledge. Rightly interpreted and understood by both reason and intuition, the stupa mirrors the harmony and perfection of universal principles, and it invites the human mind to awaken to its full capabilities.